Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning to everyone in Valley Forge and out there in the Internet. Welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters. I am your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. Today I have with me our regular contributor, Pastor David Whitney, Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution, Mr. Phil Duffy, normally with us, an instructor at the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, is taking some time off this week. David and I will be joined in the second half of the hour by a guest from down my neck of the woods, Dr. Herb Titus, the former founding dean of the Regent University Law School, who will be calling in from Chesapeake, Virginia. You may recall last week we reviewed the idea of nullification as a means of negating some of the federal government's illegal and unconstitutional acts. And we heard from Mr. Ben Lewis of the 10th Amendment Center, who's doing some great work in tracking nullification actions across the country. Nullification has some real limitations, which I listed, but it has some real strengths as well. There are certain instances of federal overreach which lend themselves well to a nullification action, others which can't be addressed meaningfully in this particular way. So this week we turn our attention to a problem plucked from recent headlines, judicial activism. What is it and what can we do about it? What should we do when the Supreme Court renders an opinion that seems to fly in the face of legal reasoning? How should we address this as a people? So the term legal activism is defined in many different ways. The Heritage Foundation says judicial activism occurs when judges write subjective policy preferences into the law rather than apply the law impartially according to its original meaning. Perhaps the most famous statement by a Supreme Court justice, which seems to encapsulate the idea behind this, occurred when Associate Justice Thurgood Marshall described his judicial philosophy as, "You do what you think is right and let the law catch up." That's just a remarkable statement for a Supreme Court jurist. Ignore the law and rule based on your feelings of what is right or wrong. This is, of course, based on the doctrine of legal positivism, which replaced natural law theory in the late 1800s. Legal positivism holds that the only relevant law is whatever man creates. And since man is constantly evolving, so goes their theory, the law must continually evolve as well. And who best to guide the evolution of the law? Why, the judges, of course. In another candid moment, Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wondered aloud whether the court had gone too far too fast with their Roe v. Wade decision. Well, we'll be talking about that later today. The Chicago Tribune wrote this about a Supreme Court decision: to say or suppose that a free people can respect or will obey a decision so fraught with disastrous consequences to the people and their liberties is to dream of impossibilities. No power can take away their rights. They will permit no power to abridge them. And this might seem to be speaking about the Obergefell decision, but actually this was written in 1857 in response to Dred Scott. So let me pause here to remind our listeners, whether you're hearing this over radio or over the Internet, that you can call in questions at any time during the show. The call-in number is 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255. And the first caller to give us a question for the day, we'll receive a free pocket constitution. If the lines are busy, you can email us at production@1180wfyl.com, and we'll get your question on the air. I'd also like to thank our longtime sponsors, Valley Forge PC Repair and ShopRite, and welcome a new sponsor to We the People. Coincidentally, it's called We the People T-Shirts of Williamsburg, Virginia. In fact, I'm wearing a We the People T-shirt as we speak, and as my friends can attest, I do so at least one or two days every week. They help me communicate important messages that people need to see more often. And my shirt today carries the message, the government's first job is to protect the people, not run their lives. David, who said that? The government's first job is to protect the people, not run their lives.
Oh, that's a good trivia question. I'm thinking it's Thomas Jefferson, but I'm not certain.
Well, it is the great Ronald Reagan, blessings to his name. And you can get your own copy of that T-shirt and others at wethepeopleshirts.us. So let's get started. David, how do you define judicial activism, and discuss some of your favorite examples?
Well, thank you, Gary, and I appreciate the Heritage Foundation's definition, and would just add a little bit to that definition. The idea really stems from what our three branches of government are supposed to do. We need to understand that the legislative branch only makes law. That is the very first words of the Constitution after the preamble. All legislative power herein granted resides, that is, it rests permanently with the legislative branch alone, so Congress of two houses, the House and the Senate. That is, judges do not make law, they cannot make law, and judicial activism is actually them attempting to make law, to act as if they were the legislative branch, when in fact they are only to apply the law, and they're only to apply the law in the case that has come before them. And again, this is one of the misunderstandings that has happened in our day, that many people assume that once the Supreme Court rules and issues their opinion, and by the way, that's the only thing courts ever issue, you see right at the very top of everything they publish, it's called their opinion. So it's their opinion on the Constitution, it's their opinion on how the Constitution applies to the particular case before them. So many people, for example, say that Roe v. Wade is the law of the land, but the reality is not one law has passed. It's only an opinion by the Supreme Court, and the opinion only governs the parties who've come to the court. So really, Roe v. Wade only governed Roe and Wade and nobody else across the rest of the country. Judicial activism claims that Roe v. Wade applies in every state, in every case, and therefore everyone must bow down and obey it. The Obergefell decision here yesterday, I understand, the clerk there in Kentucky was put in jail for refusing to obey the Supreme Court, essentially, refusing to obey an opinion that governed Obergefell and the others to that case, but didn't govern the clerk in Kentucky who took an oath to the Constitution, not an oath to obey what black robe lawyers in Washington, D.C. say, but what the Constitution says. And so there, I think, is judicial activism, is the judicial branch acting outside of the limited powers that were granted to it in our Constitution. In fact, Hamilton, in one of the Federalist Papers, said that he believed the judicial branch was the least dangerous branch of the federal government. Ha! Well, it might have been in his day, but today it is the most dangerous branch of the federal government, as the clerk of the court there in Kentucky can clearly attest. Well, there's a long list here, and I've just picked four that, to me, illustrate the overreach where the federal judiciary really is acting outside the law. The first one I want to talk about is Wickard v. Filburn. This is a case as a result of the unconstitutional actions of FDR imposing socialism during the New Deal, which really I think is better labeled the Bad Deal. But anyway, one of those was to restrict farmers. The farmer could only grow so much crops on his land each year, and so on and so forth. That's completely in violation. The federal government has no power to control what farmers grow on their land or how much they grow on it. Well, anyway, Wickard was a farmer who grew wheat on his own land, and he fed this wheat to his own hogs on his own property. He didn't sell it. He didn't exchange it for anything. He didn't actively use it for anything other than feeding his own hogs. And the federal government went after him and claimed, you violated our agricultural laws that say you can only grow so much wheat, and you can't do this and that and the other thing. And they got him. And this is their contorting the text of the Constitution. They got him because they claimed he was violating the Commerce Clause. Wait a minute, the Commerce Clause? Excuse me, he didn't have an economic exchange with his pigs. The pigs didn't pay him for his grain. He fed his grain to his own pigs on his own property, and there isn't any interstate commerce in any way, shape, or form. Part of what Farmer Wickert was doing, but they claimed. And this is their contorting the text of the Constitution to make it mean something our founders never intended it to mean. They twisted it to mean that, look, because he didn't sell his grain to the grain elevator, and therefore there was less grain in the system that ultimately would cross state lines in some transaction at some point in time, some of this grain is going to cross state lines, and so some of his grain did not enter into the system to cross state lines. By depriving the system of his grain, therefore he was engaged in interstate commerce. What a ridiculous, twisted thing. It's the same thing that the court did here in the Obamacare case, where they claimed because you don't participate in the system, you are somehow committing an act of interstate commerce. Just completely twisting and contorting the text, in a sense, rewriting the words of the Constitution unconstitutionally. They cannot amend the Constitution, but in Wickert v. Filburn, essentially they did amend the meaning of the Commerce Clause in their twisted thinking. Another one that is just groundbreaking in terms of the disastrous changes it brought upon our country is Griswold v. Connecticut. This was a legislative act in the state of Connecticut that made it illegal to sell contraceptives and so on. And because the state of Connecticut said that's our jurisdiction, we have power over this area. Well, the Supreme Court basically played legislator here, saying we're going to strike down the statute of the state of Connecticut, even though the U.S. Constitution doesn't give us any area where we have been given power by the people to do anything in this area of life, and what happens in family life, and what happens, and the statute basically said nobody can buy contraceptives, not even married couples. And so the case, Griswold was saying, no, we as a married couple want to do that, and we're suing the state. The state court ruled against them each and every time, even up to the highest state court, and so they appealed to the Supreme Court. But their reasoning here is also very twisted. They reasoned that they saw something in the Constitution that nobody else saw ever. They saw a right to privacy. And some of them say, well, maybe it's in the Ninth Amendment, but the real truth is, from that opinion, is they saw it in the penumbras and the emanations. Whoa, what in the world is that? The average person hears the word penumbra, they go, well, that must be some fancy legal term. Well, you look it up in the dictionary and you find penumbra is just a shadow. So they're saying the Constitution, and specifically the Bill of Rights, somehow casts a shadow. And in that shadow, we, the Supreme Court, see something that nobody has ever seen, that you have a right to privacy that is secured. Well, maybe it's the Ninth Amendment and something. Maybe it's the Fifth. Maybe it's the, who knows? They really don't have a good interpretation of the Constitution that gave them any ability to do what they did in Griswold v. Connecticut. But this was a groundbreaking case because this right to privacy directly contributed to the reasoning in Roe v. Wade leading to abortion and the reasoning here in Obergefell saying, look, these sodomites have the right to their privacy and to commit these acts which God has condemned in the privacy of whatever. So this right to privacy that they found, it was not in the Constitution, but they claim they found it in the shadows of the Bill of Rights. It was Griswold v. Connecticut. Again, they were playing legislator. They were rewriting the meaning of the Bill of Rights, and they have no power to do so. Their job is to simply interpret the Constitution and then apply it to the case that comes before them. Otherwise, they are acting outside of their powers that we the people have granted to them. Well, another famous case dealing with freedom of religion is the Lemon v. Kurtzman case. And this one's so important because it became the standard of what they call today the Lemon test. And the Lemon test is a test by which they say, if the government is making some decision that deals with the issue of freedom of religion, you know, let's take a case where, someone is teaching something in school that others would claim, well, wait a minute, that's a religious teaching you're engaged in there. And, you know, the wall of separation between church and state, which we know is a false interpretation, is not in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, not anywhere except in a letter from Thomas Jefferson, and it's misinterpreted by the courts. Even as Jefferson used it in that letter. But so there's an issue, and they're going to say, we're going to use the Lemon test, that is the test that they derived from this case, Lemon v. Kurtzman. And this test involves, does the person involved have a sincere religious belief? Well, wait a minute. Who has the power to determine, other than God, if your religious belief is sincere? Who can see into the heart of man and discern whether somebody's playing a game and they're really a hypocrite or whether they have a sincere religious belief? Another part of this Lemon test is, does this action involve entangling the civil government with religion, or excessive entanglement? Again, entanglement's not forbidden, but excessive entanglement is forbidden by the Lemon test. So they have established this test. It is a fascinating thing. If you read in our course, we walk through the details of what the Supreme Court has ruled on this Lemon test. But they use it when it's convenient. They ignore it when it's not convenient. In other words, this Lemon test that they've invented gives them enormous power, again, to not play judges, but to play legislators, to play those who have enormous power over what happens at the local level. And let me comment on this as well, because the design and why Hamilton said the judiciary is going to be the least powerful form of government or branch of government is because they were designed to strike down federal statutes that violated the Constitution. Instead of what they do today, most of everything they do is to strike down state statutes. Well, I know my time is running, so let me just quickly mention the fourth one, and that is Kelo v. New London. This was a contorting of the text of the Constitution in terms of eminent domain. The Fifth Amendment says that if the government is going to take your property, it must be for some public purpose, and they must give you just compensation for the land that they're going to take from you. Well, in Kelo, the city of New London wanted the property not to build a school or build a highway or do something that was a very clear, direct public purpose, but rather get the people off this waterfront property so they could put someone else, in other words, another private owner of that waterfront property that would actually give them, the state, a larger stream of revenue, or not the state in this case, the city of New London. So they were just shopping for a higher-priced resident on the land that would give them more property taxes. And the Supreme Court said, that's fine, that's a public purpose, in a sense, completely destroying the whole idea that eminent domain is a very carefully nuanced idea that must not allow the government to go about stealing people's property anytime it chooses. So these are four examples of judicial activism where the federal government is way outside the boundaries of what our founders designed for the judiciary.
Well, thanks for that rundown. And I should point out that the Griswold v. Connecticut is a particularly onerous one. I call it the Supreme Court's DIY project, because, as you said, they kind of constructed this right of privacy from little bits and pieces they found lurking in penumbras. But the important thing is that they then took that right of privacy that they constructed and built upon it in Roe v. Wade, in Lawrence v. Texas, in other later opinions as well. So once we allowed the court to establish this right of privacy, then they can use that however they want, and they have to great effect. So great examples. Thanks for that. And I want to point out that, as we kind of saw in your examples there, there's different nuances to judicial activism. Sometimes it's contorting the plain meaning of the Constitution. Sometimes it is abusing precedent. If you go out to the Heritage Foundation's website, you'll find that they list nine different types of judicial activism. And we're going to talk about some more in an upcoming case here. In the living constitution, the whole idea of the living constitution, when they put, embed that in their ruling, that is judicial activism as well. But let's talk about Lawrence v. Texas. Lawrence v. Texas was a 2003 case in which the Supreme Court nullified or struck down a Texas law that would, had made illegal homosexual sodomy. Now, the problem with this ruling and the way the opinion was laid out is that they referenced international law and international courts in demonstrating that the American legal system was behind the times, and that the, that other courts in the European Court of Human Rights and the British Parliament had both decided that sodomy was not going to be criminalized, so therefore we need to get on the bandwagon here and keep up with the times. Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that permits the court to look outside the boundaries of the United States in determining what the United States Constitution says. So who cares what a European Court of Human Rights decides on a particular issue? The issue is, what does the Constitution say about this? So that's a particularly bad way that the court in Lawrence reached out beyond the confines of the Constitution to inform their decision. And as you said, David, the decision is just that. It's a decision. It's an opinion. And it is not law. Consider this. If the Supreme Court opinion became law, then how, and therefore the part of the supreme law of the land, how would a future court then change that? How would they ever review and reverse their previous opinion? The only way to amend the Constitution or the supreme law of the land is by amendment. So if the court's decision becomes law, then a future court could never reverse it. So it doesn't become law in that sense. There's several great quotes on that. If I can remember them, I'll bring them up. But so Lawrence v. Texas was once again building upon this right of privacy that they had established in Griswold v. Connecticut. So when people didn't object after Griswold, they didn't object to the fact that the Supreme Court had been on this do-it-yourself project, then the court takes that as a green light. This must be okay with the American people, and then we can just use that as part of our doctrine. In Norton v. Shelby County, the court said, in the ordinary use of language, it will hardly be contended that the decisions of courts constitute laws. They are, at most, only evidence of what the laws are and are not of themselves laws. They are often reexamined, reversed, and qualified by the courts themselves whenever they're found to be either defective or ill-founded or otherwise incorrect. So an opinion is an opinion. It really legally only binds the two parties of that particular case. It really shouldn't be considered law. So we as the American people have the opportunity to say, oh, that's not law. We're not going to abide it. We're not going to give it the status of law. And we're just going to go on with our lives under that view. So Lawrence v. Texas, another case of judicial activism. And I want to remind our listeners that they can call in at any time and give us some questions to field. 610-539-TALK, 610-539-8255, and get yourself a free pocket constitution by doing so. David, anything to add on Lawrence v. Texas?
Well, Lawrence v. Texas basically struck down God's law, and God's law says that sodomy is a crime. You know, crimes are different than sins. Sins are only punishable by the church or by family government, church government, family government. Crimes are those sins which God's law has said civil government has the right to punish. And therefore, Lawrence v. Texas was a strike at God's law to say, oh, we are higher than God. In fact, we are God. When you see the nine black robes there, you ought to bow down and worship them because they believe they are God. At least the Lawrence v. Texas opinion expresses that they believe they are above the God of the Bible.
Well, that's a great point. And that was another terrible effect of Lawrence v. Texas, that the state cannot put into effect its sense of morality. And so when we come back from our break, we'll talk about this and some remedies. What can the people do in the face of judicial activism? We'll be right back after these words.
Working for your liberty right here in Philadelphia. Broadcasting freedom shining light throughout the tri-state area. Streaming freedom shining light from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station. WFYN.
Fox News Radio, I'm Paul Stevens. No slowing for Europe's migrant crisis. About 300 migrants breaking out of a Hungarian camp near the Serbian border, heading toward a highway connecting southern Hungary with Budapest. Meantime, British Prime Minister David Cameron saying his country will step up.
We will continue with our approach of taking them from the refugee camps. This provides them with a more direct and safe route to the United Kingdom, rather than risking the hazardous journey which has tragically cost so many of their lives.
David Cameron speaking in Portugal. Vice President Joe Biden asked again about running for president.
There's no way to put a timetable on that. If I can reach that conclusion that we can do it in a fashion that would still make it viable, I would not hesitate to do it.
The vice president speaking last night at a synagogue in Atlanta, Georgia. Fox News, we report. You decide.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
We the People t-shirts, where freedom is always in style. Famous quotes from patriots throughout U.S. history printed on the back of our t-shirts. We do over 25 quotes in a variety of colors. High-quality t-shirts with a meaningful message that make people think. Encourage others by reminding them about patriots of conviction who have gone before us. Order directly from wethepeopletshirts.us. For more information, call 757-645-8878.
A nation of well-informed men who have been taught to know and prize the rights which God has given them cannot be enslaved. It is in the region of ignorance that tyranny begins. A quote from Benjamin Franklin.
Constitution Matters. I'm your host, Gary Porter, and I have with me David Whitney, senior pastor at the Institute on the Constitution. We've been talking about judicial activism, and David and I listed some significant Supreme Court decisions which or cases which constitute judicial activism in one form or another. And we kind of hinted towards the end of what some of the remedies are if we encounter judicial activism. So let's go through some other ones. First of all, we have the possibility of amendment. We have, in fact, the 11th Amendment as a direct action taken in face of a Supreme Court decision in Chisholm v. Georgia. The court said that private citizens can sue states, even though those states are sovereign entities. and it rendered their verdict that way. The Congress said, well, we don't think so. We think that we want to protect state sovereignty, so we're going to amend the Constitution to take out or to modify the provision that the court was relying on in Article 3. And so they did. So they passed the 11th Amendment. The 13th Amendment also was primarily the result of the horrendous Dred Scott decision. So you can pass amendments as a result of Supreme Court decisions to put right what you think was rendered wrong by that Supreme Court decision.
Another interesting one, Gary, is the 16th Amendment. That was actually also overturning a Supreme Court decision that said this type of taxation is illegal, it's unconstitutional, and they recognized the only way around that Supreme Court decision was to amend the Constitution.
Well, yes, and the 26th Amendment as well. The Congress tried to lower the voting age to 18 by legislation, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that, so we have the 26th Amendment. So amendment, even though it's a very difficult and challenging process, is an avenue. And, of course, that would place the Supreme Court's decision kind of permanently in the right context, because an amendment just is going to be there for a while. Another power that the people have through their Congress that very few people realize, because it's buried in Article 2, Section 2, is called jurisdiction stripping. And it gives the provision of the Constitution provides the Congress with power to remove from the Supreme Court's jurisdiction any particular topic. Now,
and actually Article 3, Section 2, excuse me, Gary, but that
Article 3, okay.
Gives them that power to say this certain case or this certain issue is out of the realm of the Supreme Court in that it cannot be appealed from the state courts. Normally, any state issue that rises to a higher level in a state court can be appealed to the Supreme Court, but the Congress can cut that off and say, no, sorry, in terms of appeals, for instance, they could do this with abortion, no appeals regarding the issue of abortion can come up from the states.
Well, and the court has recognized that this is a congressional power. The case of Ex parte McCardle, the Supreme Court had already heard oral arguments on this issue, but they had not yet rendered a verdict. And so the Congress wanted to take this jurisdiction away from the court, and so they passed legislation, the president signed it, and delivered it to the Supreme Court. And before the Supreme Court could render their verdict or publish their opinion, they shut the case down. So the court has recognized that this is a power, a legitimate power, given to the Congress by the Constitution. And over the years, Congress has from time to time exerted this power. In 1996, they successfully stripped the federal court's jurisdiction to review certain INS decisions. So it's a power that is used from time to time, although I find that some congressmen don't understand that this provision exists in the Constitution. So I would encourage all of our listeners to have a conversation with their representative and their senators and find out if they understand this. Do they understand that the Congress has this power, and are they willing to use it if there's an appropriate reason? Now, I should point out that this whole topic of judicial activism is well covered in several books, and I want to point out a couple of them. How to Dethrone the Imperial Judiciary by Dr. Edwin Vieira. If you really want to understand Lawrence v. Texas, for instance, that is a great book. In fact, Dr. Vieira concludes after reviewing the opinion in Lawrence v. Texas that was an impeachable offense, that the justices exhibited bad behavior, that is not good behavior, and should be impeached for their opinion. Now, that brings to mind that we often think of federal judges holding their jobs for life. Well, that's not what the Constitution says. It says they hold their jobs during good behavior. So as long as their behavior is consistent with the Constitution, then they can continue in their job. And if it deviates from what we believe is their constitutional duty, then they should impeach them, which brings us to our next remedy, impeachment of judges. We've done this many times. Go ahead.
And that one, we need to remember, the impeachment doesn't actually remove them from office. Impeachment's the action of the House to bring up articles of impeachment, that is, specific charges that are going to be tried in the trial conducted by the Senate. So the Senate has to vote to actually remove them from office. But the actual act of drawing up those articles of impeachment is strong enough to get some people to back off from the tyranny that they've been engaged in. Consider Richard Nixon. He was never actually impeached. Many people falsely believe he was. They were only drawing up articles of impeachment, and it was enough to scare him that he resigned from office. And I've seen other cases where even if one legislator stands up and says, I believe articles of impeachment should be drawn up, and nobody else agrees with them, nonetheless, that one brave legislator doing that can cause those who are acting imperially, as the judiciary is today, cause them to begin to back off and be more circumspect and not abuse their power to such an extent.
Yeah, and I see we have Dr. Titus on the line, so I'm going to quickly summarize here with a couple more remedies. Of course, the president can refuse to enforce a judicial activist's opinion. There's nothing that says he has to enforce something that is, A, not law, and, B, unconstitutional. So there's examples of this, and another remedy is presidential pardon, which some presidents have used when they found that laws have been used improperly. And then finally, nullification, which we discussed last week. Well, I want to take a moment now to introduce Dr. Herb Titus, who's on the line with us from Chesapeake, Virginia. Dr. Titus was the founding dean of the Regent University Law School and a great speaker that I've listened to on many occasions. Dr. Titus, good morning.
Good morning, Gary.
How are you today?
Well, I'm doing well. How about you? I've been listening to you and David. It's been very interesting.
Well, we've had a great time with this discussion because it is a very pertinent and timely topic. The American people need to understand what judicial activism is and what they can do about it. What is your view of what the people should be doing in the face of judicial activism, particularly perhaps you could speak on the Obergefell decision?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to go back to first things, and that's what is implied in judicial activism, is that somehow the court is acting without authority, acting outside its lawful authority. And why do we use the word activism when to characterize judges who act outside the authority that they have as a judge? Well, it takes you back to the book of Exodus, in Exodus chapter 18, where Moses is explaining to his father-in-law the role of the judge. His father-in-law had observed him and wondered, well, what are you doing? And one of the important things to remember is that the act of judging is one where the judge does not take the initiative, but it responds to something brought to them. Here's the language in Exodus. It says, when they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another. Now, notice what that indicates is that the last thing a judge is supposed to do is go out and look for a fight. He's supposed to wait for people to bring a fight to him. And even when that occurs, it is between one and another, not between one group and another group, but between individuals. And this, of course, is the very foundation of case or controversy that's found in Article 3. That's what they understood the judicial authority to mean, is that they can resolve cases between two parties, but they can't make rules governing everyone. After all, if you make rules governing everyone, then you're depriving people from their day in court. And this, of course, is what's happened with judicial activism in America, is that the courts no longer decide cases or controversies. They no longer wait for a controversy to come to them. When a controversy does come to them, what they do is they make it into basically a legislative hearing. You know, one of the interesting things, Gary, is the growth of amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, in the last several years. Why is there such a proliferation of amicus briefs? Well, the reason is because The court is acting outside of its authority, acting like a legislature. And so all of the different interest groups, if they're going to be heard on a matter, if they're not parties to the case, then they come by way of a friend of the court brief. But it demonstrates that the court is acting outside of its authority, no longer basically waiting for individual disputes to come to them, and in that way basically despoiling the American system that has this three branches of government, with the courts taking over basically the legislative branch, and at the same time the executive branch stands by and lets them do it.
Right, and we let them do it too. We the people let them do it. That's probably the worst thing, because let's go back to the Constitution's first three words. It doesn't say we the judges. It doesn't say we the Congress. It doesn't say I the president. It says we the people. It is our document, and when it is trampled upon, we need to take umbrage and take action. Would you agree?
Well, yes, and of course what we see today in Kentucky is a young, is a woman, clerk, who is doing her duty. She understands her duty under Romans chapter 12, Romans 14, and basically is enforcing the law according to the law of God, and is doing her civic duty. And now she's being punished for not being passive and doing whatever the court orders someone to do. And this is one of the problems with judicial activism, has come legislative passivism and executive passivism. And so I think we have to understand what's going on here, and that's that we have elected officials who hide behind the skirts of the court on issues that they don't want to deal with. They don't want to deal with the same-sex marriage issue. It's too volatile an issue. It's too uncomfortable. They'd rather the court take care of it, and that's what the court has done, and that's why they're falling all over each other to carry out the court ruling.
Well, and this is not something that is new to us. As far back as 1830, Justice Joseph Story saw that this was a possibility. He wrote in his commentaries on the Constitution, "The truth is that even with the most secure tenure of office during good behavior, the danger is not that the judges will be too firm in resisting public opinion and in defense of private rights or public liberties, but they will be ready to yield themselves to the passions and politics and prejudices of the day."
And particularly their own individual prejudices, such as Justice Ginsburg and Kagan demonstrated in the Obergefell case, where they had taken a position on an individual basis that was in favor of same-sex marriage and refused to recuse themselves when the matter came to before them as judges. And, of course, once you bring matters before the United States Supreme Court, they're not even bound by their own precedents. At least the lower federal courts and the state courts are supposed to be bound by the Supreme Court precedents, but the Supreme Court isn't bound by its own precedents.
Yeah, I'm
so
puzzled by
it. It sets itself up as its own standard. Instead of the Constitution as it is written being the standard, it's their opinion in any particular case.
I'm often puzzled by the fact that there hasn't been much more of an uproar over the lack of recusal by those two justices. I mean, it seems obvious to me that they should have, given their previous activities, recused themselves. Yet nobody, I don't see a groundswell of opinion rising to get them to get the Congress to act on that. I think
no,
it's
if ever,
offense.
If anything, what you're saying is that if a judge would recuse himself from participating in a civil marriage ceremony between people of the same sex, and they recuse themselves, they would probably be driven out of office.
Right. So we've turned everything completely upside down.
Wasn't there a move among, I guess, the attorney generals of the states that were party to the Obergefell decision,
David,
to see if any of them would attempt to call for a retrial?
Say that again, David. You were kind of
wasn't there an
over
attempt
Dr.
among the attorney generals of the states that were party to the Obergefell decision to call for a retrial and say, because these justices have not recused themselves, a fair trial was not held, they need to recuse themselves and the whole thing be reheard?
Yeah, well, recusal has become basically an individual decision, unaccountable to anyone else, unreviewable by anyone else. And so, as I think, David, you were saying earlier, or Gary, I can't remember which one of you, is that they see themselves as gods. And they they have the authority to do whatever, basically, they think they are entitled to do. And there's no accountability with anybody else.
Well, and that brings up... Go ahead, David.
No, that's tragic, because that means we are not under a system of law any longer. We're under a system of men who happen to be wearing black robes.
That's true. Let's go back and look at the Obergefell decision, because actually Justice Kennedy leaves open an opportunity for legislatures to take steps with regard to same-sex marriage, because a sentence in, of his opinion said, well, with respect to the asserted basis for excluding same-sex marriages from the right to marry, it is appropriate to observe these cases involve only the rights of two consenting adults whose marriages would pose no risk of harm to themselves or third parties. Notice what Kennedy is saying is on this record, there is no evidence that same-sex marriage is not harmful to the people who are getting married and harmful to third parties. And yet there's a slew of evidence out there of the harm to the individuals and harm to society, the public health. And yet we now assume that this decision applies no matter what the evidence might be.
Right, that's a great point, and we ought to all make sure that our representatives understand that little nuance in Justice Kennedy's opinion and bring that to their attention and say, what about this? What about these third parties, the children of these supposed marriages or the children they adopt? Those certainly their rights and their future needs to be considered.
Yeah, and all this decision is based on a record in which that particular claim was not made. A legislature can go back and reexamine the issue based upon those kinds of findings. And this is precisely what legislatures did with the United States Supreme Court decision back in the 1960s with regard to capital punishment. The legislatures didn't just roll over and say, well, I guess our capital punishment statutes are unconstitutional because the Supreme Court says so. No, they went back to the drawing board. They went back and re-established their policy with regard to the death penalty. They didn't just roll over and play dead.
Right. It took them a few years, but they did it. That's a great point. And that's why we have capital punishment resumed in the country, is because the states went back and did their homework.
And the great danger today is that the capital punishment issue remains unresolved because of justices like Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, who now think that the Constitution outlaws the death penalty, notwithstanding the clear language of the Fifth Amendment with regard to grand jury indictment of capital offenses. And this is really important to understand, is that this court is a runaway court. This is not the same court as the 1960s. It's not a Warren court, as bad as the Warren court was. It's not a Rehnquist court. It's a different court. And we see the weakness revealed in Chief Justice Roberts, who on some occasions is right, and on other occasions he looks like a scaredy cat.
Well, and it brings up his most famous saying from Obergefell. Who do we think we are? Just who do we think we are? Well, here's the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court saying that, as though he's powerless to even answer his own question.
Well, and you have to turn the question back on him, and who does he think he is, when
right.
In the Obamacare case, didn't have the courage to say that the individual mandate was in fact a tax, but only said that there's a reasonable basis for calling it a tax. Well, that's abandoning his responsibility as a judge in interpreting the statute and applying the statute. So, yes, we can thank God for his strong statement in dissent in Obergefell, but in many ways, he's part of the problem and not a solution.
Exactly. We hearken to the days of the Rehnquist
court. The situation there in Kentucky, I know that the clerk is now in jail. Would it be possible, because the lesser magistrate also takes an oath to the Constitution, that the sheriff or whomever on the local level could spring them from jail and say, this is an illegal arrest, this is an illegal imprisonment, we're not obeying the Supreme Court because they don't make law?
Yes, they could. And another thing to point out is that, hey, how can this judge summarily put this lady in jail? Where's the right to jury trial? This is a criminal case. He knows that she's not going to say, well, okay, I guess I will issue the licenses. So it's not a civil contempt. It's a criminal contempt. And I would hope that the lawyers would present to the judge and say, you can't do this. This is it's a criminal prosecution, and in all criminal prosecutions, it has to be a trial by jury.
Well, unfortunately, we have across the nation bowed down to this imperial judiciary, and we need to fix that. We need to get people to understand that that is not the way we should be viewing the court.
Well, what's happened, of course, is it's a destruction of the Constitution itself. You know, the Constitution is a covenant. There are two major principles of covenant at stake here: limited modifiability and binding on future generations. But we live under evolutionary law, so that there really isn't anything fixed. Everything is in flux. And so that undermines the very nature of a Constitution. A Constitution serves as to set fixed principles that don't change. If you have an evolutionary view of law, nothing is fixed. Everything changes. And in so doing, it undermines and guts the Constitution, so it's no longer a Constitution. It's just a agreement that can be changed by the parties any way they want to.
Well, that's a great point. And I want to mention to our listeners that you're going to have an opportunity to expound on that on Constitution Day, September 17th. Next Thursday at the Foundation for American Christian Education's Lessons for Liberty series. We're hosting you, and encourage everyone to join if they want to hear more on this, because you're going to get into this topic of what has been the effect of the Obergefell decision on the Constitution. Is the Constitution, as we have traditionally understood it, now dead, as you kind of allude to? So people can listen in on your presentation anywhere on the Internet just by going to livestream.com if they've signed up for the event. There's a $10 charge to attend. It's nominal. But go out to www.face.net and find the registration applet. Get on registered for Dr. Titus's presentation and learn more about the Obergefell decision. Well, anything more to add, Dr. Titus?
No, it was just nice to talk with you, Gary, and David as well. God bless you guys.
Thank you very much for joining us.
We want to have you on a future show because, as I was telling David before we started, you're just a wealth of knowledge, and I love to hear you expound on and bring together the Bible and our present legal system, because there is an inexorable connection between the two, and people need to understand that connection. So we'll see everybody next week on We the People, the Constitution Matters. I'm going to leave you with Sam Adams, who said, "It does not take a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority keen on setting brush fires of freedom in the minds of men." So if you're going to set some brush fires, you'll need some kindling, and that's where we come in. See you next week.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer.
We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.